From PRX, this is the Moth Radio Hour. I'm Jennifer Hickson, senior producer at The Moth, and I'll be your host this time. The Moth is unscripted, true tales told by regular people and raconteurs. This hour, we have four stories for you. We'll hear about the ground rules for working at a suicide hotline, some online wedding contest shenanigans, the long life of sibling rivalry, and some backstory on how Hurricane Katrina shaped the administrator for the Environmental Protection Agency, Lisa Jackson. This first story is from Brian Finkelstein. He's been telling stories and hosting for The Moth for about a decade. The story takes place at a suicide hotline, and while it's not graphic in any way, it may not be appropriate for all ages. Some names have been changed to protect anonymity. Here's Brian Finkelstein, live at The Moth.
So the standard commitment to work at the humanitarian suicide hotline is 6 months. Most people work 6 months and then they leave quickly. Some people volunteer, like a few make it a year. Nobody really goes beyond a year. I was a volunteer there for 4 years. It started when I was 22 years old, and I was young, and I believed in things, because I was 22, and I thought maybe I could help the world. I wanted to help people because I was young enough to believe I could, or that if I could, that I would want to. I was that age, and so I decided I was going to be a psychiatrist, a psychologist. That's what I wanted to do. I wanted to be a clinical psychologist, but the problem was I was a 22-year-old freshman at Queens College, which, if you know Queens, it's not a great college. It's in Flushing, New York. It's not a nice place, and my GPA was a 2.0, so I was 22, so I was going to have some problems getting into a master's program, which is very competitive for clinical psychology, so I decided I needed some work credit, internship, something to help me out, some leverage, so I decided to volunteer at the Humanitarian Suicide Hotline. So I show up one Saturday, at 8 a.m., and I walk into this church on the Upper West Side in Manhattan, and I walk inside, and there's a bunch of people milling about, but I see this guy that's clearly the guy in charge. He's sitting on the desk. He's sort of like an ex-hippie turned a little corporate. He's got like a flannel shirt tucked into khaki pants. You know what I mean? He's dipping a chamomile tea bag into an NPR cup. I know who this guy is. I get it. He's a vegan who drives a BMW. I know it. So clearly he's in charge. He tells us his name is Glenn. He's like, hey, check it out. All right, my name's Glenn. And then he thanks us all for coming and says, hey, even though we're in a church, you know, I just want you to know we're not affiliated with any sort of religion or God. So if you're here for that, let me just say straight out, if you're here for God or any sort of politics or religion, you should leave now. And right then, like some old dude in the back just goes, see ya, and walks out the door. And then he sits down, and even though he's got this like corporate Jewish metrosexual hippie thing going on, he's also got a little bit of a Louis Gossett Jr. drill sergeant thing going on, because as soon as he starts a training class, he's starting to weed people out. People start dropping. There was this one guy who was sitting in the back of the class and was drinking a 40 of beer. The class, I should say, was at 8 a.m. again, just to point that out. So he was gone. There were these two teenage dudes from Queens who every time they talked, they were like, hey, bag, and then they'd high five. They were gone. There was a woman who did a mock phone call with Glenn, because in the two-week training class, he did mock phone calls where he pretended to be callers, and Glenn was pretending to be this 70-year-old dude who was HIV positive and had just found out he had AIDS and was very upset. And he was talking to this woman, Nancy, and he was, you know, Nancy was doing the phone call, and she goes, well, I just want you to know that's very upsetting. I'm very sorry for you, but you did choose this lifestyle, so gone. Now, one of the most important things Glenn weeded out, he said, was people who were there because they were either suicide survivors, meaning people whose family members, they've lost somebody because of suicide, or because they themselves, the volunteer, had contemplated or tried to commit suicide. And as Glenn would say, yeah, check it out, you're really not a good fit, gone. And so they would leave. At the end of 2 weeks of training, out of 58 people who came to volunteer, there was only 4 of us left. Because Glenn was really good. But I will tell you right now, I was better. Because what Glenn didn't know about me was that about 4 years before this, I lived in San Diego, California. And I bet you Glenn never knew that when I lived in San Diego, I was dating this girl, Tracy. And Tracy was addicted to meth. And I was addicted to Tracy. So Tracy would try to do the meth. I would try to do her. Neither one of us would ever be satisfied. That's addiction. So one day, Tracy slept with my best friend Babyface, the guy who looked like Morrissey. That's probably why she slept with him, because she was into that. She slept with him, and I had it. And I bet you Glenn didn't know that I then jumped in my 5-speed puke orange VW fastback, an awesome car, and I drove up to my dad's house in Del Mar, California. I was living in San Diego, and I went into his garage, and I took his 38, because my father's a retired cop, and I bet you Glenn has no idea that a 38 doesn't have one of those clips that you put in. It's got the thing, and you put the bullets in, and you snap it, and it's really easy, even if you don't know how to use guns. And I grabbed a bottle of tequila out of my father's liquor cabinet, and I got in my car, and I drove to Torrey Pines Beach, and I took the gun and I drank about a half a bottle of tequila. And I bet you Glenn has no idea that a gun like that is really easy, because if you pull the hammer back, it's sort of like has a hairpin, like you can just tap it and it's going to go off. And I took the gun and I stuck it in my mouth. And I'll bet you Glenn has no idea how good it feels to stick a loaded gun in your mouth. It feels incredibly good. I'm not a handser. Things aren't going good for me. I'm just pointing it out. Like, just saying it right now in front of, it feels good to have control, to say, like, I'm going to put a gun in my mouth and I'm going to have some control over something. And I sat there and I put the gun and I was trying to contemplate doing it. And then tequila makes me a little dramatic. And I threw up. I'm not a good drinker. I want to be the guy that drinks a bottle of tequila, but it's not me. I'm not Bukowski. I'm Dr. Phil. And I threw up all over the gun. And there's nothing that sort of snaps you out of a suicide impulse than throwing up on a gun. It really just sort of clears your head. And I took the gun out, and I thought to myself, well, at least I know I'm not the type of person that's going to pull the trigger, which I don't know. For me, it's something I had to find out that way. And it also snapped me out of the suicide, and I felt really good, and I felt like this moment of clarity, and I wiped the throw-up off of me, and I got out of my car, and I was in Torrey Pines, a beautiful beach, and I went into the water. It was late at night, beautiful full moon, and I went in the water, and it was, like, perfect, and I had what, for me, was a perfect life moment. I sat there under the full moon in the water, just feeling really good, the waves sort of washing over, and I realized that's what life is. That's enough for me, because there's these moments of beauty, like moons and oceans, and then there's moments of horror, and then it's good again. And then it's horrible and kicks you in the face. And then it's good again. And then it's horrible in a pigsty, because that's what life is. But then for a moment, it's good. And for me, that's enough. But I bet you Glenn didn't know any of that, because I never told him. So at the end of 2 weeks of training class, out of a series of 58 people, four of us are left. Now we walk into the training room, and there's the hotline room. And just to give you an idea what it looks like, there's three desks with phones, there's a couple plants. And there's a couple things that hang on the walls. There's a list of phone numbers. There's Glenn's home number in case you need him. There's poison control. And then there's 911, in case you forget what 911, the number for, shouldn't have to write that down. And then there's a sign that hangs on the wall that says the motto of the hotline, which is shut up and listen. Big block letters, shut up and listen. And that is an amazing expression to me. That is exactly why I stayed there for 4 years. Because after 6 months, I got my certificate. I was free to leave. But I ended up staying for 4 years because of that thing. Because it made me feel good to work there for two reasons. One, listening to people's problems on the phone, you start to feel to yourself, you know what? I don't have it so bad. These people have it a lot worse. To me, it's like if you go to the park and you sit on a bench and you look down and you see a squirrel and you say, well, at least I'm not a squirrel. You know what I mean? It's something. And two, seeing the sign shut up and listen, it's how you do prevent suicides. It's what you do is by listening to people. We don't listen to each other. We have agendas. It makes sense. Whether it's somebody you love or relationship or people you don't like or just casual, we all have agendas. We all trying to get something and we like to talk. I clearly like to talk a lot about myself. I'm up here. But the idea of sitting and listening to somebody else talk made me feel good, and it made me feel like I was helping. And that's why I stayed for 4 years. Now, the way the training basically says that what you do is you answer the call, you say humanitarian suicide hotline, thanks for calling. You then listen to somebody, be an active listener. You have to be an active listener. Glenn said not to get scared of silence if there was silence on the phone, because check it out. Silence is a form of communication, right on. He also said that you can't get manipulated by silence. So if it lasts 5 minutes, you gotta hang up the phone. Don't get manipulated. At the end of 12 minutes, end the call, because that's about the allotted time. And before you ended the call, you had to evaluate the person's level of suicide. And the way you do that is you ask a series of four questions. One, do you feel so bad that you think about suicide? Two, do you have a plan for how you would do it? 3, have you set a time for when you're going to do that? And 4, have you taken any steps today to kill yourself? Now, in the 4 years I worked there, 99.9% of all calls are yes, no, no, no. A lot of people think about suicide, but a lot of people don't really go the next step. And what he said is the only thing that he would offer as a bit of advice was the biggest, clearest thing, a warning sign, that the closest thing to a warning sign that you can have for suicide is if somebody says something like, I don't want to die, I just want the pain to stop. And if you hear somebody say that, that they want the pain to stop, that is about, a bell should go off. That's a person who's on the edge. So 4 years later, I'm working at the hotline. I come in for the overnight shift. I walk in there. It's me and my shift partner, a guy named Adam. Adam's a communist, not relevant at all to the story. Just a little detail. You're welcome. So me and Adam are working the overnight shift, and it's busy till about, the overnight shift's 11 at night to 8 in the morning. You have to do one a year, or one a month. And it's busy till like 4 a.m., till the bars close in New York, and then it sort of slows down, and it gets slow. And around 4 o'clock, it was my turn to answer the phone, and the phone rings, and I pick it up. And I say, hello, humanitarians, can I help you? And this very young, cute, scared voice comes on the phone and says, hi, my name's Amy, I'd like to talk. And I said, what's up, Amy? What's going on? And she says, oh, nothing. I was just, you know, calling because I was feeling a little sad. And I was like, oh, what are you sad about? And she goes, I don't know. Things are pretty good. You know, I have good grades at school, and my parents don't get it, but they love me. And, you know, I have a good friend back in Tennessee where I'm from. And, you know, NYU's good. I have good friends here. I have friends who are, she said she had two types of friends, which I thought was really funny, and I use it all the time, is that she had bar friends, and then she had movie friends. I like that expression. I wish I had some movie friends, but so be it. And right away, I pictured her the way you do when you talk to somebody on the phone. I pictured her in her dorm room, and I pictured like a quilt, and I pictured her with like long hair sitting on her bed and like rollerblades and like a Dr. Pepper. You know what I mean? I got her figured out. And so I said, well, that sounds good. But you said you were sad. What do you think about when that happens? She goes, I don't know. She goes, I don't understand what happens. I can't control it. She goes, sometimes when I have a great day, what I do the next day is I try to duplicate it. I wake up at the same time. I try to eat the same food, try to have the same pattern so that I can control the day so that I don't feel bad. But then, out of nowhere, she said she feels what she described as a hand coming from behind her and sort of pushing her down. And I said, okay, well, what's going on when that happens? What are you thinking about? And she goes, everything, nothing. I don't know. This feels so stupid. She started to feel uncomfortable. And then we sort of started to, flirt, like not in an inappropriate way, but look, a lot of the callers I talked to over the years were crazy. She could have been a movie friend if I had met her some other situation. So it wasn't inappropriate, but I was talking to her, and we talked for a little while, and then she said she felt dumb because of depression. She felt like, yeah, she felt this sadness, she felt this crippling sadness, but she thought that depression was overused as an expression and that there are people who are clinically or socially or chemically or whatever depressed, but she thought maybe she was just, a lot of people are lazy or overuse that word or use it as an excuse, and she was worried she might be like that. And I can identify, I feel the same way, I feel that way. You know, I don't think I get depressed. I mean, sure, there's days where I don't get out of bed for 4 days, but I'm not depressed, right? So we were talking like that, and then I noticed that it was about like time to wrap it up, and I was about to wrap it up, and Amy starts to tell me this. She was telling me the story about going to some place with her family one day, and they went out to get ice cream, and her father bought her ice cream, and it was a great day, and I said, oh, that's great. And I looked at the clock, and I was about to wrap it up, but then I noticed what started to happen was Amy started to slur her speech a little bit, and I said, Amy, what's going on? Are you okay? And she goes, yeah. She goes, look, I know it's selfish, and I know it's stupid, but I can't do it anymore. I just want it to stop. And I said, what do you mean? What do you mean by it? She goes, I don't know. I can't. I just want you to talk to me. I was like, well, when you said it, what did you mean? She goes, look, I don't want to die. I just want the pain to stop. And I woke up. And I said, Amy, do you feel so bad that you think about suicide? And she said, yes. And I said, do you have a plan for how you would do it? Yes. Have you set a time for when you're going to do it? Uh-huh. Amy, have you taken any steps today to kill yourself? And she said, yes. And I said, Amy, what have you done? And she told me she took 20 high-strength painkillers. And I said, what kind of painkillers? Because that's what you're supposed to do. And she told me, and I wrote it down. And I threw a pencil at Adam, who was nodding off because he's a communist. And I handed him the piece of paper so he could call poison control so I could have some information about what would happen so I could pass it on to her. And I said, I just tried to keep Amy talking. I was like trying to ask her about like other things. And she was again talking about that day her father bought her ice cream, and it was very confusing. And then Adam came back with a piece of paper. He had called poison control. And I said, Amy, given the fact that you took 20 high strength painkillers, are you, and that you drank and that you haven't thrown up, which she had told me, do you understand that you could you could die within an hour? And she started to cry. And I said, Amy, look, do you want help? Do you want me to do something? I can do something. I can only help you if you ask. Our policy was not to intervene unless people wanted it. I said, if you want help, I can do something. She goes, I do. I don't want to do this. And I said, great. What's your address? She gave me her address. I handed it to Adam. He went to go call 911 because the number was on the board. And I kept Amy talking. And after a while, I just tried to ask her anything, and I was like, Amy, what kind of ice cream was it that your father bought you? You mentioned that your father bought you ice cream. What kind of ice cream was it? But it was silent. And it was silent for 2 minutes. And it was silent for 5 minutes. And I'm supposed to hang up the phone, but who the hell could hang up the phone? So I didn't. And then it was 7 minutes. And then around 13, 14 minutes, I heard noises at the door because Adam had called 911, and I heard like people knocking, and then I heard the door crash open. I heard footsteps, and then I heard this voice come on the phone and said, it's okay. We've got her. Click. And then I went home. And I was supposed to go to class that day. I had classes at Queens College, but I didn't go back to Queens College. I never went back to Queens College. I never graduated. I was supposed to go back to the hotline for a debriefing based on that phone call. I called Glenn and told him I quit, that I wasn't coming back. But check it out. Click. And then I did all the things you're not supposed to do in that situation. I obsessed about it, and I stayed up, and I drank, and I smoked, and I drank coffee, and I searched. It wasn't the internet, but I looked through the papers and listened to the radio. And finally, after 3 days of it, I found on the Daily News, in the Daily News in New York, page 23, a small paragraph that said that they had found the body of a 23-year-old NYU student named Amy Walters, who died of an accidental overdose. And I know why they call it accidental. I get it. There's insurance reasons, religious reasons, family. They don't want an epidemic to start in a college. I get all that. But what I didn't know was that I was, until that moment, that I was the last person to talk to her. Not her mom in Tennessee or her best friend or some boy at NYU who probably had a crush on her that never talked to her and probably, no, me. And I wanted to call her family, and I wanted to try to go down the funeral, but I knew it was inappropriate, and so I didn't. And the thing of it is, for me, I have had bigger personal tragedies over the years. I think we all have. People do. I spoke to her for less than an hour 20 years ago. But she's me in that car, and I think about it every day. If I had pulled that trigger, that would be me. And she never got to find out what I got to find out, which is, it's terrible sometimes, but there are these perfect life moments, and that's enough. Thank you.
That was Brian Finkelstein. His solo show, First Day Off in a Long Time, which includes parts of the story you just heard, was featured at the HBO US Comedy Arts Festival. In a moment, we'll be back with Brian Finkelstein to talk about the Moth Story Slam, which Brian hosts in Los Angeles. Also, two slam stories, one about a couple's quest to win a dream wedding online, and another about two sisters with very different children.
Support for The Moth comes from Zillow. With millions of homes for sale, apartments for rent, photos, historical pricing data, and other resources available on Zillow.com or on their mobile and tablet apps. Zillow, find your way home. The Moth Radio Hour is produced by Atlantic Public Media in Woods Hole, Massachusetts, and presented by PRX. Thank you.
This is the Moth Radio Hour from PRX. I'm Jennifer Hickson. The Moth first met Brian Finkelstein when he told a story at a Moth Story Slam at the New Yorican Poets Cafe on the Lower East Side of Manhattan. Story Slams are a competition, and judges chosen from the audience picked Brian's story as the winner. He kept coming back, and he kept winning. Eventually, we made him a host. When he decided to move out west, we realized that maybe the time had come to take the Story Slams to another city. That was 2006. Brian has been hosting in Los Angeles ever since.
I love it. I love hosting it. It's still, like, I look forward to it every time I do it.
Hosting is a huge part of each Story Slam. There are 10 stories, and the host keeps the energy up and keeps the show moving. Because the hosts often comment and riff on the stories, they listen especially carefully. And what do you think makes for a winning story?
Some people are really good at crafting a minutia, a small thing, into a big story by being, like, a good storyteller. And then some people are maybe not the best storytellers, but they have these crazy things that happen to them that are completely unique but somehow still universal, which I guess that's what makes it good. But I think both are valid. I think the small one told well is interesting, and I think the amazing thing just blurted out is also as interesting.
I know it is an equal opportunity art in that way. I feel like everybody's kind of qualified to rock it.
Yeah, I feel that way too. I mean, I will say that because I go to a lot because I host them and I've been doing it, and I'm sure you feel this way, that my personal taste is I like the cop who just heard about the show and decided to give it a shot, or the soldier who just came back from the war, or the teacher, or you know, God, I sound like a politician. I'm talking to soldiers, policemen, you know, regular people. But you know what I mean?
Single like mothers.
Single mothers, babies. I like when babies tell stories. I like anyone... Anyone who's just not, you know, like doing this for just because it sounds fresh to me. But I'm sure to an audience, both, you know, both are valid. It's just because when you hear a lot, I like the, you know, the oddity more than the norm.
Then again, I agree for the audience. It's sometimes great when if you have a night and even if the content's great and the storytellers are a little shaky or, yeah, not exactly rock on tours necessarily, it is kind of wonderful when someone who really has a hold of the form comes and just lays it out. That's really nice. And at the slam, it's so great because you're changing, you know, it's every 5 minutes something new. So,
yeah, so you get that variety. And it is funny to watch people, and I'm sure you've definitely, because you've been doing the slam the longest, is the development of a person. Like some people show up and they tell a story and they win, or they, you know, they have that one good story and they're not a storyteller and they win, and then they come back and they tell another story. And then, like, over the years, some of those people become authors, and, like, they start to grow into this whole thing that's new for them. And that's interesting as well.
Yeah, the non-raconteurs learn from the raconteurs, yeah.
Yeah. Steal. They steal.
They steal. Brian and I later decided that we like the phrase learn from better than steal, so I hereby amend that statement. If you ever visit Los Angeles, definitely go see Brian Finkelstein host a Moth Story Slam. And now we'll hear two slam stories. This first storyteller's name is Peter Story. Yes, Story. Here he is at the Los Angeles Grand Slam, where we partner with the public radio station KCRW. The theme that night was Golden Opportunity.
The fall of 2009 found me and my then-fiancée, Megan, trying to plan a wedding. And we were unemployed, we came from humble beginnings, and no matter how much we tried to crunch the numbers or plan the most banal, menial wedding possible, it was just not going to happen. And we were a little upset, you know, because we were in love and we were ready to start our life together. And things were complicated because I had just gotten her to L.A. We had done a long-distance relationship across to Michigan, and I had to leave her behind. She had to stay and run our apartment complex. That was my normal job. And I had to book out to Sacramento to work as an actor in a professional theater where, ironically, we had met before. I was going to be gone for a long time. And right before I left, she said, you know, I think I found a way for us to have a wedding. And I said, what? She goes, well, I found this online contest. It's called the Southern California $100,000 Dream Wedding Giveaway. I found it on a website called Broke Ass Bride. And I said, listen, and the skeptic, the realist, you know, came out to me and I said, listen, the fine print, you're going to read it. You're going to find out it's not really doing what it's going to do. And even if we entered it, we're going to lose to someone with a terminal illness or an Iraqi war vet. It's just going to happen. So I blew it off. I went up north. I started doing my thing. She came up and visited me a couple times. And after the holidays, she came and visited me again. She was only there until Friday. And on Friday, she said, you know, today's the last day to turn in the form for the Southern California Dream Wedding Giveaway. Please. And she coerced me into it, and I said, fine. I started filling out the form, and the perfectionist in me took over, and I kind of started getting into it, these cute questions and how you met and what's your song and all kind of stuff. And we filled it out, and like an hour before it was due, we turned it in online with over 600 other couples, and I went, done. And she went back to Los Angeles. About 2 days later, we got a phone call. Megan called me to tell me we made the top 10 finalists. I found out right before I was going on stage in the dressing room, and I flipped. Because all my worry and my fear up to that point kind of dissipated, because this was confirmation that there was a chance. There was a chance. And there were two more rounds of the competition left to go. We had a voting round, and then there was a big party at the end that all the vendors and sponsors would go to. So we started a massive campaign. It was internet voting, and it was kind of tricky because it was only one vote per IP address. So basically, in layman's terms, it's one vote per computer. Couldn't hammer the vote button 100 times. So you had to reach out to everybody. So we got a Facebook fan page, and we were calling, doing bulk emails, getting a hold of teachers and relatives we hadn't talked to in years, didn't want to talk to for years, just begging anyone to vote. I was driving around with my laptop in my passenger seat of my car, pulling over in front of restaurants. I had Wi-Fi and linking in and voting. I was doing a show at the end scene. I had a tuxedo, so I came out in my tuxedo to the lobby and met every patron and handed them a flyer to please vote for us. And Megan was doing her best down in LA, but no matter how many votes we get, we couldn't top Amber and Tyler. And Amber and Tyler were this couple that just kept pulling ahead, and they were every fear I had personified. Tyler was a firefighter battling testicular cancer. Impossible. So we had to, you know, dig deep. So I got my buddy Jacob, who was friends with Panic at the Disco, which was this huge band, and we got them to put on Twitter to tweet our link to vote, and went out to 90,000 people. Bam! Overnight. Overnight, we went from hundreds of votes down to hundreds of votes ahead, and they responded. Tyler's mom contacted the Live Strong Network, and thousands of cancer votes just started piling in. There's nothing we could do about it. We went underneath. But you know what? It wasn't over yet. There was one level left. The party. And even though we got second place in the votes, it all came down to the decision at the party. And the problem was I couldn't go. I was in Sacramento. And Megan was in Los Angeles. And I couldn't make it. I didn't have an understudy. There was no one to cover me. And my sister's putting the fear of God in me, going, you got to get down there. Showing up is 90% of it. You're going to lose. And there was nothing we could do. So Megan, brilliant, cuts out huge cutouts of my face and puts them on popsicle sticks and hands them out to four of our friends that went to the party. So even though I wasn't there in body, in every photograph, I'm there in 2D. And they bring all the couples up on stage for one final kind of dating show game Q&A, and they ask my wife, you know, what do you think about Peter? What makes you think about him? And she talked about the kiss and how it felt like home, and it was beautiful, melted people's hearts. And then we went to Amber. And Tyler wasn't there because he was recovering from surgery. And they ask Amber, what's funny about banking? Because apparently she was in banking. She goes, what's funny about banking? He goes, yeah, well, tell us something funny about banking. She goes, I don't think there's anything funny about banking. And she looks at her sister. Her sister freezes. Her sister looks at the MC and goes, can we have another question? She tanked. She tanked. And everyone that went to the party that night said that when it went up to her, she was a cold fish. And I closed my eyes and hoped. We went to bed that night. Megan went to bed. I went to a friend's house who had been with us the whole way. And he said, dude, just enjoy the journey. You lost it. They can't not give it to them. The public backlash from, you know, not having the cancer winner. It's just enjoy the journey. So I went to bed. 2 days later, 9:30 in the morning on Valentine's Day, we got the call and we won. We won the whole thing, and the fine print was true. We got the ice sculpture and the cigar bar and the photo booth and the free dress and the tuxes and the hotel rooms, and it was unbelievable. And for two kids on unemployment, it was a dream wedding. And 3 weeks today, we celebrate our one-year anniversary.
That was Peter's story. He and Megan are still going strong. To see a picture of them at their wedding, or to view some of the YouTube videos they made to secure their win, visit our Radio Extras page at themoth.org. Our next story is from the Moth Story Slam, sponsored by WBEZ in Chicago. This story also deals with competition, but of a very different sort. Here's Diane Castile, live in Chicago.
I've never been a particularly competitive person, and when it comes to my sister, it's best not to even try. She is the luckiest person I have ever known. Always in the right place at the right time. She married into money so she can buy anything she wants, but she wins everything, or uses points, or has it bequeathed to her. She plots out her life step by step, follows that plan, and that works. The hand of fate seemed to lovingly caress her instead of slapping her upside the head, which, as far as I know, is its job. Because of all this, my sister has developed a life philosophy that's simple and airtight. Good people make good choices and therefore have good lives. Now, in my circles, life is more like a series of rough drafts. So over time, my sister and I drifted apart. But then we started having kids, and I thought, well, maybe this is something that will bring us together. In fact, our daughters were born within months of each other. She had twins. I just had the one. And for a while, things really were better. But I soon discovered that perfect people have perfect children. My sister's daughters tested as gifted in school, were the star athletes for every sport they went out for, really talented artists, I mean, you name it. Meanwhile, my daughter was racking up labels of her own. ADD, OCD, mood disorder, you name it. It's hard to describe how toxic the effects of these challenges are on one so young and how far-reaching their effects. School is a nightmare. Sports are out of the question. And even extracurricular activities really just don't take. But the worst is the social ostracism. And that's the one thing that, as a parent, you can do absolutely nothing about. When my daughter was 10, she mentioned suicide for the first time. And so we had to take her for an emergency appointment with her psychiatrist. Now, I had an infant at the time and couldn't get a babysitter at such short notice, so I had to ask my sister to help out. Now, she had a tennis game scheduled, and those are sacred, so I had to really make my case and tell her, you know, what my daughter had actually said. And to my surprise, she was very compassionate and actually apologized for having kind of turned a blind eye to the struggles my daughter had had for years. That's okay, I told her. You know, it's so hard to know how to handle situations like this. But if you could just ask about her from time to time, you know, it'd be such a balm for me just to be able to talk to you about this. But for whatever reason, my sister never mentioned my daughter after that night and would avoid any discussion of her. The year all three girls were set to graduate from junior high school, my sister sent out an email to me and a bunch of other people in February asking us to hold the date for their graduation party, you know, like you do for weddings. The email read as follows. Please hold June 10th for Amber and Tiffany's graduation from junior high school. In their 3 years there, they have made the dean's list every single semester, typically earning straight A's. They've participated in sports year-round, usually as captain, and sometimes juggling more than one at a time. This year, they took on the additional challenge of being confirmed at our church. Through it all, they've maintained a large group of the right friends who share their same values. Now, I love my nieces, and I'm so proud of them, but I read this email, and I thought, we cannot go to this party. It's just going to be a list of their achievements and awards and full of their friends, and my daughter will not be able to handle it. And of course, neither will I. So when the invitation came, I threw it away. I never told anybody about this, not even my husband. I mean, what kind of person boycotts a child's party? And their nieces. As luck would have it, my daughter found the invitation in the recycling bin and asked me about it. And I said, we can't go because we are going to the beach that day. Now, my daughter hates the beach and was at the age where she'd argue with everything I said, but she just looked at me and didn't say a word in protest. Well, the day the party arrives, and it is lousy. It's overcast and rainy and cold. And so my husband and my other kids were like, we're not going to the beach. But my daughter astonished me by getting up early, getting food together, pulling out the beach stuff, even packing the car. So the two of us got in and drove to the beach. And we got there, and the weather was even worse, but pulled out everything, laid out the beach blanket, and sat down and watched Lake Michigan. Now, I thought my daughter would retreat into her iPod or maybe even just stay in the car, but to my surprise, she sat down and curled up against me. I mean, she was almost a full-grown woman at 14, and she was practically in my arms. And we just sat there and watched the water until it started to rain, and then we sat there some more. And to this day, I don't know why neither one of us made a move to leave, but I guess we're thinking the same thing. Sooner or later, this has got to stop. Thank you.
That was Diane Castillo. Diane asked us to dedicate this story to her daughter and other kids like her. Diane is a writer who's done a lot of work in the nonprofit sector, but has also completed the University of Chicago's Great Books program and studied improv at the Second City Conservatory. Have any of these stories made you think of your story and how we should put you on the radio? Well, pitch us. If you don't try, you'll never know what might have been. Call our pitch line. Takes 2 minutes. Record it right on our site, themoth.org, or call 877-799-MOTH. That's 877-799-6684. In a moment, our final story from the woman appointed by President Obama to head up the Environmental Protection Agency, Lisa Jackson.
The Moth Radio Hour is produced by Atlantic Public Media and presented by the Public Radio Exchange, PRX.org.
This is the Moth Radio Hour from PRX. I'm Jennifer Hickson from The Moth. Our final story is from Lisa Jackson. When The Moth teamed up with the World Science Festival, we were especially thrilled to learn that Lisa Jackson agreed to tell a story for our show. She is the first presidential cabinet member we've ever had on The Moth stage. Before the show, we started wondering, who are all these tall, well-dressed men in our green room? They have walkie-talkies and earbuds and, Secret Service. Here's Lisa Jackson, live at The Moth at the World Science Festival.
My father was in the Navy in World War II. So when he was done, when the war was done and his time was up, he came back home to New Orleans. I'm from New Orleans. His family had been there for generations and looked for a job. For a black man in New Orleans in the late 40s and 50s, job options boiled down to mailman, Pullman Porter, and daddy picked mailman. And so he was a postman. And, you know, back in the days when postmen wore their uniforms and walked through the neighborhood, and I couldn't go on the route with him, but we would walk around, and sometimes I have memories around Christmas waiting for him to come from his last round so we could go out and buy the tree or do whatever we needed to do. But he would take me from time to time, and his route included parts of the French Quarter. And I just remember having this feeling when I was with him. Now I think I know it was the first burgeonings of what real public service was, because, of course, a mailman was about delivering really important things. For those of you who don't remember, Social Security checks used to actually be a piece of paper, and people would wait for them. They were really important, and the mailman would always ring the doorbell on the day they came to make sure that check was in your hand, especially for poor people or people who really needed to make sure they got it. And I remember that feeling of real responsibility, of really having a role in the community that made me very proud. It was, you know, no different if my dad had been the mayor. And I think that that feeling of community service stuck with me to the point where I remember once he took me to the Central Mail Processing Facility in New Orleans. And I remember looking up at him adoringly at the end and saying, "Daddy, I want to work for the post office." And like any striver in the 60s, by that point it was the 60s, my dad looked at me and said, "No, sweetheart." And perhaps he had a sense of longevity and career respect by the time I would actually be doing it. I have no idea. But he, of course, wanted more for his baby girl. So my dad passed away when I was in high school. And by that point, I had moved on from a dream of being a mailman to a pretty clear talent for math and science. And so when you're the first kid to be going to college in a family and you're good at math and science, there's really only one career choice that your mom can think of, and that's, my baby's going to be a doctor. So my mother would say when I was valedictorian in high school, she'd say, "My baby is going to be a doctor." And everybody knew I was going to go to Tulane. Roll wave, Tulane? No. and I was going to be a doctor. Now, I have to admit that this is a scientific part of the story, so you don't get worried. I did, when I was in high school, I went to Tulane for a summer program to find out what this thing called engineering was, because I had no idea, and I went because they were giving away a free HP programmable calculator. So yes, there is nerdiness in there. But I get to Tulane, and I'm still going to be a doctor. I'm going to be an engineer and be pre-med at the same time. And I was okay. I was doing fine. And then, but it was the late 70s, early 80s, and Love Canal was the talk of the town. And Love Canal, for those of you who might not know, was a big dump in outside of Buffalo, New York. And it was actually a canal that was started by a man named Alfred Love. And he started a little bit of it, and then he lost all his money and he stopped. And they poured chemical waste, industrial waste, into the canal. And then they covered it over, and eventually pressure forced that waste out and it oozed into people's basements. And I do remember thinking in college, if a chemical engineer, which is what I was studying to be by that time, can make the processes that make all this goop, it's going to be an engineer who figures out how to clean it up. And cleaning up that waste was inspired an entire federal program, our federal Superfund program. And that's when I decided to be an engineer and work on environmental issues. So I go home and I tell my mother, and I say, "Ma, I'm not going to be a doctor. I'm going to work to clean up hazardous waste. I'm going to be an engineer." My grandmother said, "Baby, why do you want to work on a train?" And my mother just gave me the look. If you know the look, if you have a mother from the South, you know, you might know the look. And the look was one of, "But you're going to be a doctor, right?" So anyway, I did believe strongly, and the more I learned about the field, that it wasn't medicine, but it certainly could make people healthier. So I finished college. I actually went to graduate school at Princeton. I came out and somehow found myself in public service and worked at EPA, and then eventually worked for the state of New Jersey, right next door. New Jersey? strange, strange in New York City, but go Jersey. And so there we are in New Jersey, and I go home, and my mom still has the look, but it's okay. But it's her birthday. My mom's birthday is August 27th. It's 2005, and I go home to be with her on her birthday. And that's a momentous period, because that's when Hurricane Katrina hit the Gulf Coast and, of course, New Orleans. So I was home. I was with her. I drove her out. There was a Saints game on the night before. I remember distinctly not wanting to leave because I couldn't believe we had to get up after a Saints game and leave. But we did. And I remember her grumbling and me grumbling, and we drove up to northern Louisiana. And of course, I lived in the Ninth Ward, and you know what happened in the Ninth Ward. We were very fortunate. My immediate family, my stepdad, everybody got out. That's not true of some of our other relatives and certainly some of our friends. But my mom's moved. So now I'm explaining to my mother, and after the hurricane, it becomes clear that one of the reasons, besides the fact that there's a man-made failure of engineering, the levees broke, but the other reason that a storm that shouldn't have caused the damage it did is because the wetlands that should have been there to protect the city were gone. They've been cut by oil and gas lines and by years of engineering that had unintended consequences. And finally, my mother came to understand why environmental engineering is maybe better than being a doctor. Thanks. That's for her. See, you can learn. Now, net, so we keep moving forward. So the hurricane hits, and I'm working in New Jersey, and I really had a moment where I thought, I've been in public service my whole life. It's not the highest paid career. If I had just gone and taken my talents to the private sector, I could have bought her a new house. I could have raised the one she had. I could have done so many things for her. And I really had a crisis where I thought I need to leave and go make some money so I can help her. And it was my mom, because she now understood how important my job was, who convinced me to stay. And I'm glad she did. And as fate would have it, not too long after that, I became head of the New Jersey Department of Environmental Protection. And not too long after that, in 2008, came a call from President-elect Barack Obama. By the way, my mom was totally cool with that. I think the most amazing moment, though, was being with my mom, being able to get her to Washington, D.C., and the president, being the person he is, of course, wanted to meet her. And so having my mom in the Oval Office, meeting the president of the United States, embarrassing the hell out of me. But in a good way. Love you, Mama. And so she met him. She's there. She talked to him. A woman who grew up in segregation in the Oval Office with the first black president of the United States and with her grandchildren. But where I want to end my story is what happened next, because I had one more surprise from my mom, and that is after we left the Oval Office, we went back to my building at 12th and Penn, four blocks away, and we got her upstairs, and I showed her the trappings of my office, which is quite beautiful. But it's the offices of what were once the offices of the Postmaster General of the United States. And you can't enter my office without passing through either door over the great seal of the Postmaster General of the United States. And the conference room I use every day is full of icons of male men, sorry, but yeah, they are all men, through the years. It was a long time ago they did them. And it was just cool to see all the things that I think have helped make me my strong mother and my dad and my kids and my brothers. But what I said to her is what I want to leave you with. Sometimes you have an opportunity to think about all the things that influence you. And I think we all do a little bit of reverse storytelling where we make all the facts fit. But I don't think it's an accident that I'm in that building. And every day I'm there, I think about public service. Every day I'm there, I do think about the incredible importance of clean air and clean water and understanding the effects of chemicals on our bodies and our lives and our kids. But most important, every day, I think about my dad and public service. Thank you.
That was Lisa Jackson, the first African-American administrator for the EPA. To see a picture of Lisa at our show, visit themoth.org. While you're there, you can re-listen to any of the stories you've heard on this hour or find the specific link to share with your friends and families. The stories are also available at the iTunes Store. That's it for the Moth Radio Hour. Thanks for listening, and that's the story from the Moth.
Your host this hour was Jennifer Hickson, senior producer of The Moth. The stories in the show were directed by Catherine Burns and Sarah Austin Jeunesse. The rest of The Moth's directorial staff includes Sarah Haberman and Meg Bowles, production support from Laura Haddon and Whitney Jones. Moth Stories Are True is remembered and affirmed by the storytellers. Moth events are recorded by Argo Studios in New York City, supervised by Paul Ruest. Our theme music is by The Drift. Other music in this hour from The Roots of Orcus, Tom McDermott and Evan Christopher, and Alan Toussaint. You can find links to all the music we use at our website. The Moth is produced for radio by me, Jay Allison, with Vicki Merrick at Atlantic Public Media in Woods Hole, Massachusetts. This hour was produced with funds from the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, the National Endowment for the Arts, and the John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation, committed to building a more just, verdant, and peaceful world. The Moth Radio Hour is presented by the Public Radio Exchange, PRX.org. For more about our podcast, for information on pitching your own story and everything else, go to our website, themoth.org.